You're all in for a great discussion between myself and Eric Dreitzer of Counterpunch. Make sure to check out his Patreon information in the description below. You'll also find a series of links to topics and articles that Eric discussed. We start with a recent article that Eric published entitled Ukrainian Folktales and Anti-Colonial Perspective. From there, we touch upon the YouTube Twitter crowd, Alexander Dugin, multipolarity, BRICS, NATO, many more topics. It's a great video. You're going to love it. Make sure to check out the description for the links discussed.
All right, so I have Eric Dreitzer here from Counterpunch. And I reached out to him because I had listened to some other podcasts, specifically Where's My Jetpack podcast. And Eric was on a few months ago. And many of the things that he was saying about current events, geopolitical events, Ukraine and the left, I was vehemently shaking, nodding my head to because I agreed so much. So I wanted to invite him on and kind of talk about these things. So Eric, how about just a brief introduction about yourself and your work at Counterpunch or elsewhere?
Thank you. Yes, I am a political analyst. I do my work independently. That is to say, I don't work for a news organization as such. I don't work for any government agencies. I don't take money from RT or from Al Jazeera or from any news outlet other than obviously the humble alternative media publication Counterpunch, where I do my podcast, Counterpunch Radio. And I also have a patreon.com/Eric Dreitzer. I do lots of videos, I do writing, I do other stuff there. So I kind of am living in both of these worlds, and that's kind of how it goes for those of us who are trying to sustain ourselves a little bit by putting out this kind of content online. So anyway, but that's what I do these days. I used to be very much more dated day activist. I was involved with Occupy. I was involved with the anti-war movement prior to that. During I really discovered my politics around the Iraq War and the post 9/11 period. Obviously, 2002, the lead up to the Iraq War, demonstrating along with millions of other people around the world. Obviously, we weren't successful in stopping that war, but we were successful in teaching many people, including myself, what anti-war politics was, introducing, at least for me, it was an introduction to radical politics, radical thinking. And eventually a few years later would kind of discover a bit more to add to my sort of theoretical understanding of these issues and anti-imperialism and what that meant. And actually only later did I really come around to Marxism and to some of the other ideas that I have become involved with since then. So it's been a long trajectory. I've traveled through many different quarters on the left, from self-identified anarchist to something like a progressive Democrat, to something more on the socialist left, to a Marxist, and so forth. So, there's been a lot of evolution as I've discovered more, as I've learned more, as I've tried to grow. In that time, much has happened in the last 12 years since I first started my website and started my first podcast. That was around the Arab Spring and the Occupy movement and everything that was going on at that time. And obviously, today, we seem like we are light years away from those halcyon days of 12 years ago. So anyway, so that's where I'm at now, I guess.
Yeah, I've had an interesting journey myself, I'll put it that way. But it seems like I've been in many of the places that you noted as well at different times. And but it's interesting because talking about maybe setting the scene for what is ultimately, as we had talked about a little bit earlier, a geopolitical issue. If we're talking about Ukraine, and that's kind of the modern conflict where a lot of things are happening, whether it's political or whether we're talking about the left or the sliver of the left online, as you've kind of noted. But setting the scene, you had published something called Ukrainian Folktales and Anti-Colonial Perspective. And I wanted to know if you could just speak to that a little bit in whatever capacity you feel is appropriate, and why that, what I guess, what about that book moved you to write about it?
Well, I came across a very interesting book when I was at this antiquarian bookshop here in New York, not too far away from me. And it's a book of Ukrainian folktales, and it was published in 1955. And while I'm not a Ukrainian historian, nor am I an expert on Ukrainian folklore, and I know actually next to nothing about it, to be honest with you, I knew what it was. I knew what I was looking at, even though I'm not a Ukrainian speaker. I do speak Russian. I can read in Russian, and the words are close enough to the Russian language that I knew it said Ukrainian folktales. And I was immediately sort of taken aback by that because I had never actually seen a book of Ukrainian folktales. Not to say, of course, I'm sure they exist and probably readily available for people who are looking for them and know where to find such things in archives and elsewhere. But it wasn't the kind of thing that I had ever come across normally, you know, in the course of, you know, every day looking at books. And I do look at Russian books from time to time. I have a collection of Russian books, Russian art books, and things like that that I've been interested in since I was, you know, a teenager. But I had never seen a Ukrainian book before, nor was it, did I ever see one that was illustrated as beautifully as this one was, where there were these, I mean, they look like they're hand painted, although they're obviously not, you know, illustrations of these different scenes from these different folktales. And in looking at the publication date, it immediately struck me, because I know the basics of post-war Soviet history and know that Stalin died in 1953. Nikita Khrushchev has his famous speech denouncing Stalin, and that, you know, officially, quote unquote, ushers in what's known as the thaw, the period that immediately followed Stalin, where there was some loosening of restrictions, a more openness about not only what happened during Stalin's reign, but more openness in terms of some of the more draconian restrictions that had been in place under Stalin. Anyway, it was intended to be sort of a period of a flowering of culture, a sort of a rediscovery of some of the things that had been more or less suppressed. And one of those things that was to some degree reintroduced, and I say to some degree, I guess I'll explain why I say to some degree in a second, but one of those things was Ukrainian language and Ukrainian culture, which to a large extent had been suppressed during Stalin's period. And certainly up until the early 1950s, Ukrainian language existed, but it was like a foreign language, you know, within Ukraine. It wasn't the language that you spoke at school. It wasn't the language of formal business. It wasn't the language that you used in normal everyday interactions. It might have been, especially in the western part of Ukraine, the kind of language you spoke with your grandparents, maybe at home, privately, what have you, right? So it was no longer in the mainstream of society in Ukraine under the Soviet Union. And so by the 1950s, Ukrainian language and Ukrainian culture become very significant issues, because again, we're talking just a few years after World War II, when many Ukrainian nationalists, as we know, collaborated with the Nazis in their struggle against the Soviets. So there's a complicated history that leads into the 1950s, but Ukrainian language and culture, and in particular things like these children's stories, do reemerge. Ukrainian is again taught in schools. I know that my uncle, who was born in 1937, who was in his teens by this point, my father was born in 1948. He was, you know, right around this age. He was 8 years old or so when this book was published. They come from Odessa, which was the center of Soviet Jewry. It was the Jewish epicenter of the entire Soviet Union, major Jewish population center, major cultural center. That's where my family comes from. And in speaking with my father and with my uncle, you know, Ukrainian was this kind of thing that they sort of, it was a foreign thing, right? It was a thing that it was like you studying French in public school or studying Spanish or something. It was like a foreign language, right? So in any event, in reading through this book, or I guess I can't say reading, but in thumbing through the book and looking at it and using my little Google lens to translate the stuff I couldn't read, you know, it was really fascinating to me, because it immediately became apparent how different this was from everything else. In other words, these were distinctly different from Russian children's stories, very different from the kind of stories that my family might have heard in the context of, you know, Jewish stories and Jewish oral tradition and so forth. So distinct and very much reminds me of the unique, distinct character of Ukrainian culture and Ukrainian history, right? And so that reminded me about the fact that this, that the, not that I haven't been thinking about this, I have, but this is another example of how the war in Ukraine is also a neo-colonial struggle here. And the struggle against Russia's invasion is inherently an anti-colonial one. Obviously, it's not of the same kind of anti-colonial character as other historic anti-colonial struggles in Algeria or in Congo or wherever we might think of, right? It's qualitatively different. NATO is backing Ukraine. Ukraine has friends throughout the Western developed world, et cetera. It is a different situation, but at its core, it is still a neo-colonial war that Russia is waging to essentially reconquer the area that it sees as historically part of Russia. And this is what gets back to the issue of what Lenin called Great Russian Chauvinism, the Russian attitude towards the non-Russian peoples of the former Russian Empire, which was obviously, as we know, inherited by the Soviets after the revolution. And so, you know, when the French, I'm blanking, of course, at the very moment that I need to pull his name, but the French, the famous French writer who coined the term prison house of nations when traveling through the Russian Empire in the 19th century, Lenin, of course, uses that term famously in talking about all of these issues of the Russian Empire as the prison house of nations, and not just of the Ukrainian nation, but of the Kazakhs and the Uzbeks and the Tajiks and all of the other peoples, including those within the Russian Federation today, the Chechens and the Ingushetians and the Yakutians and whoever else, right? All of these different groups within the prison house of nations. And so in thinking about that and thinking about that history where Ukraine figures very centrally, of course, that then reminded me again, as I was looking at this book, that what I was really looking at was a document of anti-colonial struggle. This was the struggle to rediscover or reintroduce the culture that had been suppressed. And that was, I thought, worth taking a moment to write about.
No, I mean, it's excellent for many, many different reasons. And I'll link it to this so folks can go look at it. But I think my next question is, you know, I very much agree with everything that you said in the framing of this. You know, it's complicated. It's not necessarily straightforward. And it's maybe different than what people are used to in the past, if we're just looking at larger, you know, NATO being involved. But I think that my question is really this. I haven't seen a lot, at least the sliver of folks that are on social media that are on the left, and we can talk about them if you'd like to even say, are they, you know, is that what they are or not? But my question is, from my experience, I haven't been seeing this war framed as what you described, even in left spaces. I haven't really seen a lot of people coming out and saying this is a colonial war against the traditional regional imperial, you know, empire force. There is colonial history involved with this. It seems very much more framed as a war with the United States and Russia, using Ukraine as like a proxy, almost as if they're like, you know, an NPC or something, not really even involved. And that it is geopolitical, but all, you know, that solidarity with people suffering from imperialism or empire just seems to be completely lacking. And I don't know, is that something that you've seen as well, or do you see different things maybe in spaces where you're at?
Well, there is some of that. It depends on what elements of the left we're talking about. If we're talking about the particularly loud squawkers on Twitter and Facebook and elsewhere, of course, yes, there's all manner of positions on the spectrum of the left. And, you know, I would sort of just caution people not to read too much into a lot of that discourse, because a lot of people are extremely cynical and they produce content for the purposes of satisfying a particular audience that they know pays them. So whether that is their Patreon subscribers who want to hear nothing but glorious, positive things about Russia and terrible things about the United States, or conversely, you know, the other side of that coin, you know, whatever it might be, I'm a little bit hesitant to really put too much stock into what a lot of different people have to say. Now, to your question, though, I do think that there is an element of that. I think that there's probably, well, I would break it into like just a few different buckets, although I'm sure there's many, many others that we could point to. I think one is a very poor understanding of the nature of the conflict. I think that a poor understanding of this conflict, to some degree, deliberately made so by Russian propaganda and the various ways in which it's disseminated through the various channels on the left. But there is, I think, a failure to understand the nature of the conflict to a large degree. I think that there is a failure to understand the history that led to this conflict, both in terms of its recent history since 2014, and especially in terms of the history that goes back at more than 100 years. Understanding that history, I think, frames this conflict differently, right? If you want to say that Russia is a victim and Ukraine is an aggressor, you have inverted the nature of the conflict, right? But that is precisely the kind of rhetoric that you hear quite often from certain quarters on the left, to some degree because they've been hoodwinked by very clever propaganda, to some degree because that is how that is the only prism through which they can view the world, namely the prism of U.S. imperialism. And U.S. imperialism as a global force is the giant elephant in the room that can never be ignored. And there and those who point to only U.S. imperialism are correct to do so to a point. The problem is, and to, I guess, to the question that you were sort of getting at, the problem is that when something happens globally that fundamentally runs counter to that worldview, wherein the United States and U.S. imperialism is the only malevolent force on the planet, that then creates a very awkward situation where people who would allegedly present themselves as anti-war find themselves tacitly supporting an egregious war crime, which is the entire invasion of Ukraine is a war crime, a crime against humanity, a crime of epic proportions, just like the invasion of Iraq was a crime against humanity, a crime of epic historic proportions in which at least a million people died. I mean, you know, and so again, I say that because when you're thinking about the way that the conflict gets framed on the left, you have to remind yourself that many of the people are beginning from an inverted reality, one in which up is down and black is white. And this is partially because of the success of Russian propaganda. This is partially because of the complicated history. Look, it is complicated. The Ukrainian nationalists did collaborate with Nazis. There were pogroms. There are Nazis in Ukraine. You know what I mean? So when you go through the list of Russia's propaganda talking points, each one of them is rooted in some degree of truth, but it is, of course, manipulated and filtered through an extremely one-sided framework that is basically, you know, tantamount to saying that Russia can do no wrong. Russia is always the on the defensive, and Russia is never the aggressor. But obviously, any clear thinking person who's been following the war knows that Russia invaded Ukraine. Russia is the aggressor in the conflict, and therefore Russia is responsible for all manner of war crimes, crimes against humanity, the atrocities, the mass killings, all of the different, you know, the sexual violence, all of the things that have been unleashed in Ukraine. The UN recently released, the UN High Commission for Human Rights recently released a report detailing just vast crimes against humanity, atrocities and sexual crimes that really that took place over just 5 weeks. So I don't want to get off the point here. I just want to say that to point out that there are plenty of people who are dishonestly evaluating this war, who are A, ignoring the human side of the war, which is, of course, just, you know, unacceptable, and B, people who deliberately misconstrue the nature of the conflict to say, for instance, this is a war begun by NATO and the United States that the Russians had no choice but to fight. naturally, that is the Russian perspective. The Russian talking point is, of course, going to say that. Why? Because it transforms Russia from a sub-imperial aggressor waging a neocolonial war against its neighbor to a victim, merely trying to fight off the much larger bully, which is the United States and NATO. Globally, that narrative lands in a lot of places, all throughout the global South, many parts of Africa and Asia and Latin America. There's a lot of receptive ears to that kind of a narrative wherein the United States, which is the global imperial bully, is the one that is stoking the conflict, right? So there's a lot of reasons why, but ultimately for the purposes of the left, I would say to just boil it down to one simple statement, the left has misunderstood the nature of 21st century imperialism and the time and place that we're living in now. Those elements of the left do not understand that we have now fractured into this multi-imperial hell world that we're going to live through, where the United States is not only no longer the single global imperial power, but it is now challenged by equally reactionary and violent powers that are not equal in terms of U.S. power, but equal in terms of their viciousness, equal in terms of their sort of malevolent effect globally. And you know what? I shouldn't say equal, because people will misconstrue that to say that it is equal to the United States. It's not equal. Rather, it represents an alternative form of vicious capitalism. That's a better way of saying that. They're not equal. It is an alternative, vicious capitalist imperialist form that has now taken the form of a far right wing fascist politics. So now the global dynamic becomes no longer one of a single neoliberal capitalist imperialism, but rather neoliberal capitalist imperialism on the one hand and far right fascist capitalist imperialism on the other.
I'm going to skip down a few. I had some notes because I think that that kind of leads directly into this idea of, well, there's a few things. I think we could talk about, for instance, a view of what multipolarity means in practice, for instance, foundations of geopolitics, you know, fourth position theory, these types of things. And I, you know, there's utility in understanding and delving into those, but I also, I think just like stepping back and looking at those on a larger scale. And again, it might be contingent upon what audience we're talking about, and that's fair, but I haven't seen a lot of pushback, I suppose, on the alternatives to the hegemon, if that makes sense. I've seen a lot of arguments to oppose the hegemon, which is the United States, NATO, the West, neoliberalism, what have you, by any means necessary. But, and this is subjective and anecdotal, but in my experience, when I try to bring up the actual, you know, quotes and words from things like fourth position theory, talking about universal human rights being imperialist, or, you know, things of those things of that nature, and the very, you know, harsh reactionary rhetoric involved in that, as well as even just pitting Russia as a victim from a Western view, and kind of stepping back and looking at this broader, you know, what has Putin's career been, 2008, 2012, 2014. And I mean, he's really aligned this kind of international conservative, you know, guild, or what we could say, but American, you know, reactionaries from Stormfront to Pappy Cannon for years have been praising Putin as well. So, yeah, you know, I think my question is, with all that said, where is that, you know, why is there that lack of criticism to the alternatives of this hegemon? What it seems as if the focus is only on NATO and the West, or if you're in the United States, your job is to critique NATO and the West and not these other countries or these other options. That might not be a correct, you know, observation. It might just be anecdotal, but is that something that you've seen, ideological, strategic, through messaging, or I don't know? What are your thoughts on that?
It depends on how you want to look at it, to be honest with you. It depends on who we're talking about. If we're talking about sort of those segments of the online community that, you know, regularly you know, swallow our tea talking points or, you know, are consuming the Russian media ecosystem. Sure, they've been talking about multipolarity, the BRICS, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, the all of the various non-Western organizations that were intended to supplant, or not supplant, but present an alternative pole to the single unipolar, you know, hegemon of the United States and U.S. finance capital. This is something that's been around for quite a while now. I mean, basically since the term BRICS was coined by that Goldman Sachs guy, 13, 14 years, 15 years, we've been talking about BRICS. And what is BRICS today? It's very little. In fact, it's another capitalist grouping that involves several non-Western countries, and it represents very little in the way of an alternative. It's the people that are associated with BRICS and the BRICS Development Bank and all of the various institutions that are associated with BRICS. These are the same people that represent finance capital and the IMF and the World Bank and the Asian Development Bank and elsewhere. So, I mean, it hasn't proven to be any kind of an alternative to capitalism finance capital as we understand it. Neither has the Shanghai Cooperation Organization proven to be anything close to a NATO-like force, which was at least at one point the vision that Russia and China would come together to develop the Shanghai Cooperation Organization to represent a balance, a check against NATO, which is, of course, nonsense, as we can see right now. The Russians and the Chinese can barely stay on the same page in terms of their talking points and messaging, let alone, you know, having a close military alliance. So, the notion of these multilateral institutions coming to supplant Western imperialist capitalist institutions, that's been proven, shown through real world experience to be nonsense, to be mostly bluster, mostly propaganda. What has proven to have been actually developed, things like China's Belt and Road Initiative, things of that nature, hard infrastructure projects, things like that, which was also very much, you know, talked about as, you know, part of the future multipolar world, etc. Much of that is also in question today, between Russia being involved in the war in Ukraine and the sanctions and the economic war against Russia over that invasion of Ukraine. That has raised questions about the viability of the One Belt, One Road Northern route. There's questions about the viability of the Southern route because of instability in Pakistan, and then the questions in Iran. And there's many reasons why these various non-Western aspects of multipolarity, as it's called, have sort of proven to sort of not, I don't want to say they haven't come to fruition, they have to varying degrees, but with mixed results, let's put it that way. And obviously we've seen COVID took a huge chunk out of a lot of these plans as well. China's economy is staggering. Russia's economy is a complete joke. So again, there's the idea of an alternative to the West is frankly ludicrous. Quite frankly, now what is happening, of course, is that there are global impacts with the war in Ukraine. So you do see countries like India and China and Indonesia and other countries that are increasing their imports from Russia, primarily energy, of course, that they're trying to take advantage of the current situation and buy Russian energy at huge discounts, et cetera, right? These things don't fundamentally alter the global economy. They're temporary changes based on current conditions. So same thing is true with the SWIFT system, the debt settlement system for interbank settlements, right? The Russians have been frozen out of that. There was always talk that the Iranians and the Russians and the Chinese were going to come together and they were going to build an alternative. They built an alternative and nobody likes it and nobody uses it, right? So I'm saying all of these things to point out just that, like, there's a huge gulf between the rhetoric of multipolarity and the reality of multipolarity. And the truth is that wide chasm is because multipolarity isn't a real thing. You're not going to have multipolarity in the true sense of the word. You had a bipolar world order through the Cold War, where you had two fundamentally different economic systems. You don't have two fundamentally different economic systems. What you have are countries that are not part of the Western capitalist imperialist system who want a piece of the Western capitalist imperialist system. And that is what, unfortunately, we're watching playing out.
Excellent. Yeah. And as you're, you know, so as you lay that out, just excellent. You know, I'm also thinking to myself internally, if I'm, you know, let's say like a Westerner and I present as left, whatever that, you know, means to the individual. And I'm hearing what you're talking about. It sounds very much like what you would hear if you're reading about the European Union, you know, the G, whatever number we're at, summits. It sounds very much like trade deals, economics, that are an alternative, but are still somewhat like a mirror reflection of what's happening in the West regardless. I'm kind of wondering, where's the leftism in that? You know, it's an alternative, but what in that alternative is it that you're really supporting? And I think that kind of like leads me to something that you had said earlier on that Jetpack podcast, where you said that some rhetoric coming from the left can sound or does sound very much like Bush era rhetoric towards Iraq. And to me, I think it's in that same vein, to where if I'm looking at things maybe online, like you're saying, I'm looking at it and I'm saying, this is the propaganda. We could say it's propaganda or Russian propaganda or people making money, but the messaging I see very much seems like an inverted version of Iraq. But it's just Nazis now, and it was Wahhabists then, or Islamic fundamentalists, or, you know, evildoers. It could be Satanists now. That's kind of a thing with messaging. And
yep.
I don't know. Could you speak to that and kind of get me on the right path with that?
Absolutely. Actually, it must have been just a couple of maybe a week or 2 weeks after the Russians invaded in late February, early March, I wrote an article for Counterpunch entitled "The Kremlin Goes Neocon." And that was the entire thrust of the article, was examining precisely what you're getting at, why it is that Russia is waging a war that is just step by step right out of the neocon playbook. I mean, right. down to the letter, from the shock and awe opening to the historic justifications to the justifications around, well, in regard to Iraq, it was Al-Qaeda and terrorism. In regard to Ukraine, it's Azov and Nazis. Similarly, you know, all of the various WMD in Iraq, biolabs in Ukraine, yes, chemical weapons in Iraq, dirty nuclear bomb in Ukraine. I mean, it goes on and on and on. And I mean, there's probably a dozen more points of overlap that I would point to, where we can see, and in fact, if you live through the Bush era, you very vividly remember that Bush and Putin had a thing. Yep. I mean, Putin, yep, had respect for Bush. He didn't love everything that Bush did. He obviously didn't approve of everything the United States was doing, but he had a grudging respect for Bush and the use of force and the way that the neocons used force, and particularly what, you know, famously, you know, Paul Wolfowitz had said about, Karl Rove had famously said about, you know, that we are the makers of reality, right? That, yes, we create realities. And while you're trying to negotiate through those realities, we create new realities. In other words, yeah, the power to create reality through your own force, that is the only power that matters in the world. That is, at a very basic level, that is neocon foreign policy thinking. The neocons believe that the United States had to use power in order to create realities on the ground around the world. That is, like, quite literally what neocon thinking is. And in fact, that is pretty much what the Russians have applied in Ukraine. And now, obviously, as with everything Russian, it's a poorly made copy of the American disastrous, cancerous American product that initially, you know, as was the case throughout the Soviet period, the Soviets, you know, famously, and now it's, of course, a sort of a retro cool thing to look at, where they would make their own copies of Western products, oftentimes much, much lower quality and so forth. Yeah. I love that kind of stuff. Yeah, right. Cool. We love that sort of stuff. So in this sense, we see it on a political level. The Russians have ruled out a badly made copy of a neocon criminal war, and they're going with it all the way. Now, obviously, the difference is stark, and that is that Russia is not the United States, that Putin is not Bush post 9/11. They don't have that kind of global power. They don't have that kind of influence over places like Europe and North America and elsewhere. So they can't just kind of will into existence a global consensus for a war that nobody actually wanted, right? Where the United States of the early 2000s could kind of do that, right? Could sort of arm twist the world global community to go along with the war that they all knew was bad, right? So there are differences, but yes, the neocon playbook is in full effect in the Kremlin. And actually it's one of Putin's, you know, principal talking points that is effective, namely that there's nothing that the Russians have done that the United States hasn't done over and over again. And that, again, is an argument that lands very nicely in a lot of corners in this world. And that is part of the reason why Biden and the United States and the Europeans and others, why they're having a hard time countering at least some of Russia's propaganda. Some of Russia's propaganda is utterly ludicrous and totally absurd and laughable, right? But some of it, especially on these type of points, is extremely effective.
And you said creating reality. I put that to the side, because I think it might transition. Because when I look at, when I'm looking at this phenomenon, trying to analyze it, and that being kind of like how the left is reacting to the modern world, I suppose, just generally speaking, I see, as you said, especially when you get onto YouTube and Twitter and these spaces, I do see somewhat of an inverted reality, and it could be based in Russian propaganda, and it could be other things, and it could be pieces too. But it seems like a lot of it kind of goes to, and it's much earlier, but it seems like a lot of it goes to Syria and what happened with Assad and some conspiracies about white helmets and what the US was doing and what Russia was doing, and that perhaps there were some, I don't know, divisions in the left at that time. I don't know. What do you think that Syria was like a pin, you know, that you put in the map of saying stuff is different now than it was before, when I'm looking at left spaces, or not really? Is this a consistent stream that you saw in Syria was just another stop on the way?
Syria is qualitatively different. You're right to point to Syria. I mean, there's a lot of reasons, and we definitely do not have time to delve into all of that. To all of that, I'm not saying it to try to dodge the question. It's hard to know where to begin, because I feel like I was a primary actor in a lot of that. You know, going back to 2010, 2011. So I will say that. All right, I will use my own evolution on the issue to try to draw a larger point. I began on that issue much more in the pro-Assad camp, namely because I viewed Syria as basically a 21st century version of Afghanistan, whereby U.S. intelligence would provide weapons to very unsavory, Salafi jihadi type fighters for the purposes of creating a quagmire, et cetera, right? So from the anti-imperialist perspective that I held in 2011 and 2012, it seemed to me that what we were witnessing was a new stage of what we had just witnessed in Libya, which was, of course, an uprising against Gaddafi, which is quickly hijacked by various intelligence forces and ultimately becomes a NATO war of regime change within months, right? And I was very active on resistance to the war in Libya, which also coincided with Occupy. I was organizing anti-war, trying to organize anti-war forces within Occupy, unsuccessfully, I would add, but that's a separate story. But anyway, that was happening. That was happening simultaneously, and the uprising in Syria had already begun. We saw what was happening in Libya, and I immediately applied that to Syria because to me it was basically two sides of the same conflict, right? Or two sides of the same issue. And I held that view for a while because it seemed the most logical one. It certainly jived with what the information was that was coming out of mainstream sources. I still remember the exact headline because I cited it so many times in the New York Times, June of 2012, CIA said to steer arms to Syrian rebels. I have that memorized and burned into my brain because I cited it hundreds of times in dozens of articles all over, right? And I forget the name of the author of that article now, but it doesn't matter anyway. So it was like confirmation of a very straightforward understanding of that conflict. And as it evolved and as things began to turn once, twice, three times, and then eventually the injection of what became the Islamic State emerges and the conflict changes again, I began to read more from Syrian communist voices, people who were from the Syrian left, who had basically either spent decades in prison or were writing from Germany or elsewhere because, you know, they had to flee the country, etc. And I began to become a little bit more hesitant about the very concrete narrative that I had been pushing about, Assad as basically fighting a defensive war against Western intelligence operation. And the more I looked at it, the more I read about it, the less comfortable and confident I was with my understanding of the conflict. And the more I began to realize that I had probably misunderstood it and that I needed to sort of reevaluate it. Anyway, we don't have time to go into all of the nuances of that development. The point being that by 2015 and especially by early 2016, it was very clear to me that the Syria issue had become a mobilizing issue for the international fascist right, and that the fascist right had consolidated itself around Syria for reasons that are very clear to me now. And even at the time, I had already begun to understand. And part of it was that the Russians were organizing international forces for the purposes of developing out their propaganda. That's where Dugin and Dugin's networks came in. Dugin and Dugin's people sent international observers from all over Europe and elsewhere, from far right parties, etc. They sent them into Donbass. They sent them into Syria to, quote unquote, document what was happening in order to develop this alternative narrative of what was going on in Syria, an alternative narrative of what was going on in Donetsk and Lugansk, etc. Right. So this is part of a global propaganda operation, and Syria was to a large degree at the center of that. And it's part of the reason why, for many of us, it became very apparent that this was not a left-wing cause, as we look to our left and look to our right and realize that it was like a neo-Nazi on one side and like a white supremacist conspiracy theorist on the other side, right? And you're like, what the fuck is going on here? Excuse me, I don't know if we can curse.
The links go to Stormfront.
So it's like, what's going on here, you know? And it increasingly became clear that I had been, at least to some degree, wrong. Now, not wrong in terms of my overall analysis of the conflict, but wrong in the sense of what I'd been highlighting as the key issues and, having to kind of reevaluate that. So anyway, in that period of time that I was reevaluating my view of what was happening, I began to become more aware of just how much it had become a cause celeb for the far right internationally. And so anyway, that's a long way of getting back to your question of, yes, Syria was a galvanizing issue that brought together disparate elements of the far right and some elements on the far left. And that, of course, brings us right back to Dugin and fourth political theory, because that is precisely the strategy that Dugin has advocated for decades, namely collaboration between the far left and the far right to destroy the center, what he deems to be the neoliberal center. That's what they put in practice. And I think Syria, and now, of course, Ukraine, but especially Syria a few years ago, is a prime example.
Yeah, it's a nice way to tie together. And it clarifies, you know, my thoughts on it as well. But I think that, I mean, first of all, I don't see too many videos on YouTube, and maybe it's my poor taste, in which people talk about how they were wrong. And I think that it's just nice to kind of be, or not wrong, but maybe need to reevaluate. And I've certainly, I do this constantly as well. But I think it's nice to hear someone say that I need to step back and maybe reevaluate when presented with new information. It's just something we all should be doing, I think. But you know, with the introduction of Dugin, that's a whole thing. But also, it feels like, and again, you can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but it feels like in this time the concept of anti-imperialism, I don't know, changed. Or what that meant change. And as I look back in research, I see articles from Syrian voices, for instance, or people from other parts of the world, and you know, trying to describe this phenomenon. Some I've seen the use of alt-imperialism, the imperialism of idiots, different ways of framing it. But was there something, you know, not so heavy as Dugin, but I'm thinking more like gray zone type things. Like, is there something that happened in that era that you think is, that you would pinpoint in terms of, you know, anti-imperialism, or, and if not, maybe, you know, like the use of anti-imperialism or anti-imperialist today, especially when you go on to these bigger platforms, YouTube, and you see the talking heads kind of, you know, using that word or co-opting that word. How do you feel about that?
Complicated. I wish I had a quick answer for you to that. Unfortunately, it is not limited to the last 10 years. And to a large degree, I would say it is to some degree a function of the nature of world politics post 1991. The collapse of the Soviet Union, leaving just the United States, the single, you know, unipolar hegemon, whatever you want to call it, right? That then engendered a kind of politics that was, at least from the international perspective, that is rooted in one very simple understanding. And it is like almost a priori kind of knowledge, right? And that is that the United States is the global imperial power, the only one. Right. There is one global imperialist system, with the United States at its head and many other countries in various ways playing their various roles. And that understanding, which has many different applications, right, that emerges in the anti-globalization movement, what we called the anti-globalization movement, yep, in the late 90s and the early 2000s, which saw U.S. neoliberal capitalism as essentially spreading its tentacles across the entire planet and seeking to make everyone into more or less a kind of a vassal of one giant, you know, globalized capitalist system, right? So the end of the Soviet Union brings about this period of a single imperial pole. And that, I think, then breeds an entire generation of politics that is rooted in not only that idea, but in seeing it in playing out in practice, right? So for my generation, I'm 19 years old when 9/11 happened. Well, 18 years old when 9/11 happened. So I was in the 12th grade. My freshman year in college is the Iraq War, the lead up to the Iraq War. So for people of my generation, there is nothing but U.S. power, U.S. criminality, U.S. warmongering, U.S. imperialism, right? There is nothing else. And we see this over and over and over again, even before Iraq. We see this with the NATO bombing of Serbia. We see this with the entire debacle over Kosovo. We see this in many, in Bosnia in the mid 90s as well, right? Many examples where the United States and NATO are the military force. The military force, and for those of us who are anti-war, it's very clear where the evil player is, right? We could see it written on the side of their jets as they're bombing innocent people. So I say all of that to say that the notion of anti-imperialism becomes essentially the notion of anti-American imperialism or anti-US war. Right, that anti-imperialism becomes synonymous with being anti-war, which is synonymous with being anti-US wars. Right, if you're living in the United States, you're not typically involved for the most part in, you know, an anti-war movement about some tiny war in some faraway place. Right, the anti-war movement is about US wars. Anti-war politics is about US wars, etc. So this is the thinking that really is relevant. Basically, all the way up until the very recent period, I would say at 2016 is where this really fundamentally changes. And I'll explain why I say that in a second. But this basic understanding is what leads us down this path, right? Because what happens then is that every time the United States invokes its military force, or really anytime the United States invokes any kind of power, the anti-imperialist position would be to take the opposite side. Right. So that is how you get to that basic sort of dynamic. And then what happens when the imperialism is coming from somewhere that's not the United States? That is when you end up in this extremely awkward situation where people claim to be anti-imperialist while supporting a clearly imperial revanchist neocolonial war, while simultaneously pretending they're not supporting it. So they're both supporting it and not supporting it. They're both imperial and anti-imperial at the same time. This is the disastrous politics of certain quarters of the left today. And it's what I'm like, you know, fighting about every freaking day.
I empathize, man. I know. But, you know, the way that you described it is superior, honestly, to my attempts, because I think that the way in which you lay it out in using history and some time, you know, time frame points, it does it in a way in which when you step back, you say it's logical. You know, at a point, especially after maybe like when you were saying 1920, looking at 9/11, the Bush era, and even stuff in the 90s, honestly, before that, but you know, especially maybe peak at that time, to say I'm on the opposite side of the United States wasn't necessarily wrong, right? But as we move forward and as things become more nuanced and, you know, different, I suppose, all of a sudden this kind of template, which is kind of, I mean, it lacks any critical analysis and it's kind of, you know, it's a template. There's not a lot going on with it in terms of theory, but you're usually right up to that point saying, well, yeah, if NATO's on the side of the plane, I'm on the other side of this, you know, conflict, bringing up to a point in which now there's more nuance involved. And maybe that was Syria, you know, or events leading up to that. I don't know, but it at least rationalizes it, because there are, I'll be honest, times where I'm looking at this phenomenon, you know, we'll call it on the left and anti-imperialism, what have you. And I'm just saying, how did we get here? You know, like, how do you go from having saying you have like solidarity with global people and then dismissing rebels and calling them like the same thing that Bush was calling people in Iraq, you know? And I think that the way that you described it helps maybe shed some light, at least on the authentic progression of things. There's always the people that are making money and the propaganda, but I do feel like, and I've tried to kind of focus on, yeah, you know, you're going to have the people with the microphones and they're going to say things, but it's more about like the audience and the people reacting to it, you know, and how are they how are they seeing this and seeing different things than I am, you know? But I think perhaps what you just stated, this timeline of events, especially maybe I'm a little bit older, but if the major events too were as you laid out in your life, I mean, that's a big socialization agent and life experience agent too. And it's been fairly correct until recent. And so why would I believe somebody telling me now that it's not right? You know,
look, the truth is that I think everyone on the left is going to need to embrace the fact that the war in Ukraine is awkward. It puts us in awkward political positions. Everybody, as far as I'm concerned, I don't feel 100% great about speaking on behalf of a country that is being supported by NATO. It doesn't make me feel wonderful to know that at a very basic level, I'm technically on the same side as a NATO-backed country. On the other hand, the people who are not find themselves on the same side with the international fascist project, with the global far right, with nearly every fascist leader, both in power and challenging for power in the world today, including Trump, including, I mean, just the worst scum on the planet, including neo-Nazi organizations, etc. So that's a pretty awkward position to be in as well. And so I say all of that because I recognize that we are now in a new and decidedly awkward political moment where I think everybody has to really take stock of what is happening and how things have changed. And I mentioned in my previous comments, 2016, I do think a lot changed in 2016. I think that the entire nature of US power was fundamentally altered with the introduction of Trump. Trump and the fascist movement that he represents, which is now a fully formed political operation that is, in my opinion, poised to take full power in the United States in the next 2 years. So that fundamentally alters everything, because what happens now is, as I mentioned earlier, where you had a divide globally between a neoliberal capitalist imperialist West and a sort of far-right fascist imperialist East, now you also have that same conflict within the U.S. ruling class and within the U.S. state between the neoliberal center and the far-right capitalist forces. And they do represent a very serious threat within, you know, U.S. state power. So anyway, that fundamentally changes how we view the United States and its relation to the rest of the world. It has to. We have to see that the United States doesn't move with a single voice and a single ruling class like it once did. You don't have that consensus like you once had. You do now see internal divisions within the U.S. capitalist class. You see whole industries on different sides of the dividing line. You see the far right waging war against big tech. You see Silicon Valley being split down the middle. You see the petrochemicals industry headed straight into the fascist, into the arms of the fascists. At the same time, you see plenty of elements within the economy, both tech and Hollywood and many other industries that are totally opposed to this growing fascist threat, at least from the, you know, nominal political perspective. And so the internal conflicts within U.S. imperialism are then a mirror of the broader global conflicts that we see. And that is part of the reason why Putin feels as emboldened as he does, in my view, at least, why he feels as emboldened as he does right now in Ukraine, because he knows that chaos is on the menu and chaos is coming.
Yeah, I think, and let me ask, because on the topic of these far right and Putin and fascists and MAGA, what you've talked about Dugin in the past a little bit, and you've mentioned him here. And I did the same podcast, the Jetpack podcast. You know, there's a discussion of kind of like how important he is. And I have personal opinions. I personally kind of think his ideas have become extremely important, but they become institutionalized and he as an individual is kind of a clown, you know.
I think that's
correct. Just my personal kind of like view on it. how important do you think he is? Because things have happened since that interview. I think the assassination attempt has happened since then. And I don't know, what are your thoughts on him if we're talking about fascists and all these bad guys?
It depends on who you ask. It depends on how you look at it. I agree with you. I've always been of the opinion that he is influential, whether he is directly influential or his ideas just kind of permeate through the intelligentsia class within the Kremlin and whatever. That could also be. I mean, we don't have time to do a full crash course on Dugin. I mean, Dugin comes out of the National Bolshevik tradition, which is ultimately a Russian fascist tradition. He is the main exponent of what is now called Eurasianism. He's not the inventor of Eurasianism, but he's the modern popularizer of this idea, which is ultimately simply a Russian imperial revanchist idea, whereby Russia, as the land power of the Eurasian landmass, has the natural right to rule the Eurasian landmass, while the British and the United States and the Japanese and others are these maritime powers that are, you know, meant to rule the West and so forth, right? And he frames these things as also civilizational clashes, not in the way of Samuel Huntington's Clash of Civilizations, but rather civilizational in the sense of completely different civilizations. That is to say, Russia is unique and distinct and different from Europe and the West and Asia, right? That it is this unique power. Anyway, there's some pseudo-historical reasoning to that, some slivers of truth and mostly a lot of horseshit. And but you know, Dugin is extremely influential primarily because his version of politics gained a lot of traction in mainstream Russian society, and rather not even so much in mainstream Russian society, but in mainstream Russian political culture. Remember that Russia is an extremely depoliticized country where 85 to 90% of people have nothing to do with politics, don't have a political opinion, don't pay attention to politics, etc. Maybe that's changed a little bit since the war and everything that's happened recently, but that is generally the case. And that is the result of, well, Russia's history. I mean, let's not forget that before 1917, there was no such thing as any form of political representation. There was simply the czar, the autocrat. You know, there was even with the establishment of a Duma in 1905, after the 1905 revolution, ultimately, you had no rights. You had no actual political rights. Then, of course, the Russian Revolution happens, the Soviet Union. Of course, rights are greatly expanded. There is a sort of sense of freedom in the early portion, early part of the 1920s, followed obviously by Lenin's death, the struggle for power, and the consolidation of power by Stalin, which then leads to all of the rolling back of a lot of those rights that had been sort of granted in the early period. Anyway, I say all of that because throughout the Soviet period, this depoliticization continues. There is no one to vote for. There is one party. You vote for the party. That you vote and you vote for the party, you know? And so Russian society is itself very depoliticized. And that is important because that then sort of leaves politics to the domain of, like, you know, the 10% of society that's paying attention. And within that milieu, Dugin emerges as a major sort of ideologue of what we would probably call the new right in Russia. I don't know that they would use that term, but anyway, so if you ask Russians, as I've interviewed Russians and asked about Dugin, they laugh about it, right? Because inside of Russia, Dugin is like an Alex Jones type figure. He's a YouTube type personality who puts out these videos of himself giving these grandiose pronouncements and pseudo philosophical jargon about whatever bullshit he's on that day, right? And people kind of laugh it off or whatever, you know, the way that you do with Alex Jones and his latest rant. But Dugin's propaganda, I would contend, has never been for Russian domestic consumption. It is really intended for audiences outside of Russia, in particular Western audiences, and especially left-wing and right-wing audiences, far left and far right audiences. And so in my view, Dugin's propaganda and Dugin's networks, and when I say networks, I should clarify what I mean. I mean dozens and dozens of websites that disseminate various Dugin talking points with an air of legitimacy, and using those websites to then launder those talking points to more legitimate websites like Gray Zone or, you know, whatever other Russian constellation site we might be talking about. So Dugin's ideas get out into the sort of digital space through these means. And that's part of the reason why Dugin ultimately ended up being extremely influential. And don't take my word for it. According to U.S. intelligence, Ukrainian intelligence thought Dugin was important enough to assassinate him. And Dugin's daughter, Dugina was herself a fascist ideologue who called Ukrainian subhumans, who called for the liquidation of Ukraine, et cetera, et cetera. So these are not the kind of people you want to be playing in the sandbox with. These are fascists, and we should be clear-eyed and sober-eyed about who we're talking about and what it is that they what kind of politics they eschew. Remember that Dugin was part of the reason why he ended up on the U.S. sanctions list is because he was the one who initiated the 2014 invasion of Donetsk by paramilitaries and the Russian fascist forces that ultimately streamed into there. He famously is held with taking a photograph of him holding a rocket launcher, calling for Russians to go and fight a holy war in Ukraine. So Dugin is not some bystander here, and he's not just some author sitting at home and writing books. He's an active recruiter, an active ideologue, a propagandist, somebody who has been intimately involved in helping to create the conditions for this war. And ultimately, if there were any justice, Dugin would absolutely be facing war crimes charges at The Hague. But I think we all know that there is no justice in this world. Because so, Bush would be right next to him.
I know you probably can't answer this, so it's not fair to ask, but I'm answering because it's just more exasperation from I think my point of view. But you brought up in that, especially at the end, how like Dugin and his various networks, his Eurasianist Party, Eurasianist networks, what have you, other bad people, RIM, whether we're talking about other white supremacist groups in Russia or just nationalists, ultra-nationalists, et cetera, working in coalition in Donbass 2014 early. What I just heard you say, and again, maybe it's the audience, and maybe that's the expectation, but I just don't see that said very much. I don't hear very much about Task Force Ruzish or I don't hear about, Wagner Group. I don't hear about what Alexander Dugin was doing at that time, or I don't hear about the Russian imperial movement. And my question is really why? I would think that even if it's for sensational, even if it's to make money and you want swastikas out there and, things like that to grab attention, and you get that maybe with Azov Battalion, but I just don't, all of that you just stated, I don't see very much at all anywhere, but including a lot of left spaces. And I just don't know why. Do you have any insight on that? Or is it a question for you as well?
Well, no, I mean, I have some thoughts on that. I think part of it is because of a lot of people don't know shit. A lot of people don't know what the hell they're talking about. I mean, one of the real big problems we have is a lot of people who talk a lot and know very, very little about what they're talking about. And this is unfortunately what you end up seeing so often among, the whatever YouTubers and, Twitter celebrities and others who are writing about these things or talking about these things. They know nothing, or they know very, very little. I will tell you right now that I am not even remotely the world's expert on all of these issues, but I at least can read and speak Russian. What I mean? I can at least, I at least have some basic, tools that I can use to do some analysis here. I can read Russian media reports. I can read their press releases. I can listen to their audios. I can, you know, follow their TV shows without subtitles and so forth. Like, that doesn't make me anything other than somebody who's got some Russian skills and has at least a little bit of background on this. Aside from that, I have a background in the politics on this, and I know a lot of these things like the back of my hand, you know, whatever. Like, what's the point? Why am I saying that? Not to make myself seem like an expert. I just mean to say that if you don't even have the basics, you can't even speak on these issues. Well, no, you can, but you're not going to speak from any knowledge. You're just going to be blah, blah, blahing. And the blah, blah, blahing is easy if you just get talking points fed to you. And if you've got a couple of websites and a couple of experts who have the right talking points that you like and that you can just regurgitate over and over and over again, hey, man, that gets you subscriptions, that gets you clicks. The clicks turn into dollars. The dollars feed your kids. And that just goes on and on and on like that, right? And so, like, I have to admit, I don't watch much YouTube. I don't watch much of these these pundits and so forth. Like, I know, you know, the ones that I interact with in my little corner on social media, but I don't follow this stuff because, frankly, I'm not interested. I'm not interested in listening to people who don't know what the fuck they're talking about, man. You know, and so, you know, I mean, that's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is that it's very embarrassing for a lot of people. It's like you said earlier, you know, like a lot of people can't ever admit that they're wrong. And I was wrong on Ukraine in 2014. I didn't understand what was happening at that time because I saw it from my very one-sided perspective, which was Ukrainian Jew is afraid of Ukrainian fascists. Ukrainian fascists are bad. My great grandfather was murdered by Ukrainian fascists in the streets in the Odessa ghetto. Okay, so like I know very clearly what this is about, like what that history was. And back in 2014, that was the only thing that I really thought about was, you know, these are fascists. Ukraine has this history. The Russians are definitely not the aggressors here, et cetera, right? And I was educated by Ukrainians that I spoke with, by learning more, by reading about you mentioned RIM, which is the Russian Imperial Movement, by learning more about the Russian far right, about learning about how it was mobilized even in the 1990s, how it was weaponized and so forth. Like there was a lot that had to be learned, a lot of background that I had to learn in order to be able to say, you know what, I think I wasn't totally right about this. You know, I was in the sense of like, I had the basics of it correct, but as with Syria, I didn't fully appreciate the scope of what was happening, and especially didn't appreciate the sort of disinformation that was informing a lot of my opinions at that time. And it took a couple years, really, before I was able to like really say, you know what, I don't think that I have the same ideas about this that I once did. And unfortunately, for a lot of people, they don't go through that critical self-reflection of any kind. They don't. They certainly don't want to admit that they were wrong, either for fear of, you know, losing credibility among their subscribers or just the narcissism that comes with anybody who makes money using their face and their voice in front of a camera. You know, I think that all of these factors, you know, go into it. I also think that there are some people that are afraid of speaking truthfully. I think that they're afraid of speaking truthfully because either they'll lose subscribers or because of what certain people might say or whatever it is, you know. And I know, and I'm not going to name names because I don't think that that's appropriate, but I can name a number of prominent alternative media journalists who have gone dead silent on the Ukraine issue, precisely for that reason, because they know that if they open their mouths and say what they know to be true about what Russia is doing, they're going to lose subscribers. And that is, again, one of the really pathetic realities of our political landscape today.
Yeah. So, I mean, in short, I was going to say, I grapple with this too. And I always go between, you know, is it really just about money? Is it about followers? Or is it ideological? Is it, you know, someone coming from a Cold War point of view or campism or, you know,
I guess those things, it's all of them. It's a combination of all of them. It varies person to person, but it's some combination of all of those things. And I mean, you know, yeah. On the one hand, we can be understanding about it. You know, I can be understanding about how that happens or whatever. On the other hand, I have no tolerance for this fucking bullshit. I'm going to tell you truthfully, these people are bending over backwards and making excuses for what we all know to be a crime against humanity of epic proportions. I will not stand for it. I will not go along with it. And I will absolutely speak truthfully about what this war is. And I don't give a damn who says what.
Yeah, man. I mean, I'm with you, and I get buried all the time on social media, and it's fine. You know, that's okay. And also, you know, you talked about, I mean, you have some very specific history regarding, you know, family history to that region. And, you know, I think it is maybe fair to say some folks just don't know, you know, and even I don't have any history like that, but I mean, I have an undergrad in history. I worked at Ukrainian Historical Society for a while. You know, I probably have things in that context toolbox that other people don't. But I think you're right. Even if you don't have that, there does come a point to where you do need to be able to accept that, you know, something's not right, like you did with Syria, and go out and you know, figure it out, right? Or go a different path. And even with me, I made one of these videos about Ukraine because I did have some history about it. And I was looking at social media and I just knew inherently, not specifically, but I knew inherently, I was like, this stuff's not right. You know, like I remember from the background that I had, like, this isn't even accurate. But after I made that video, someone messaged me and said, it's great that you did this, but a lot of people are doing this. And I didn't even understand what was happening at the time, you know, regarding that type of media. And they said, could you talk about the Russian side? And I mean, I had to go look at like research papers. I got stuff from, you know, I paid for some papers and looked at their citations and went to those sources. And, you know, it wasn't necessarily easy either. And I guess I'm just saying that too. You talked about YouTube, and I mean, we're going to be on YouTube too. And I think I would say that to everyone listening as well, is that, you know, it's not like I'm claiming to have answers either. I don't. I think it's the inversion of that, of saying, I don't know. And this is why I go out there and I look at, you know, papers, and I did like a 4-hour video on fourth position theory, but it's because I didn't understand it, you know. But it's also kind of why I look for people like you, and I reach out and ask, can you tell me? Because you know more about this than I do, to be honest, you know, and I'm kind of learning about it. And I think that kind of brings it to near the end, because it brings me to the most awkward point of this discussion. And as I talk about learning and trying to, you know, self-analyze, it things that you said earlier are what I grapple with. And you know, NATO, I think, is a big one, in that you don't want to defend NATO. It's objectively not good. And there's a lot of history that you describe to justify that. But as I've been looking at Ukraine and Eastern Europe, but maybe more even modern history, what has happened with Finland and Sweden, and looking at opinion polls over the past 20 years in Ukraine and how they've changed regarding perceptions of NATO, I do find myself in this in an admittedly awkward position of saying that NATO is bad. It is. But there are a lot of people, not governments and not ideologues, you know, but there's a lot of people out there that at one point were asked by somebody, do you think you should join NATO? And they said, yeah, you know. And I try to look at the people involved and have solidarity or empathy with them over other discussions, I guess. And it's a tough place to be, because I'm not about to sit in the United States and tell people in other places in the world, NATO is evil and you're wrong for wanting to join it, you know? But it objectively has a very bad history too. And it's something that I grapple with. I don't know. What are your thoughts on that kind of position, I guess, that awkward position of saying, look, there's a reason why folks, not governments and not, you know, but people wanted to join NATO. But again, a left perspective, NATO's not great, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's a tough excuse me, it's a tough question. I mean, ultimately, NATO is probably the single most destructive force globally that there is. I mean, when I say NATO, I include the US military. I guess yeah. I'm sort of folding those two things together. NATO is technically separate from the US military, but not really. It is the greatest force of evil on the planet. It has destroyed, I mean, at least a dozen countries in the last 2 decades. Let's not forget that the entire 20-year occupation of Afghanistan was done under the banner of NATO. The destruction of Libya was NATO. The Yep. destruction of Serbia was NATO. I mean, we could go on and on. NATO has been involved in egregious crimes against humanity. So I think that we should be clear-eyed about what NATO is. Now, your question about individuals in Eastern Europe, people, citizens of Eastern Europe wanting to join NATO, well, people are always going to respond to what they view as the immediate threats of their own experience, their own lived experiences. And for somebody in Latvia, the lived experience was the experience of occupation by Russians, yep. not of NATO, not of the United States. So it makes perfect sense why the Baltic states, for instance, immediately jumped to NATO almost as soon as they could. Essentially, why the Russians didn't make nearly as much of a fuss about their entering into the NATO orbit as they did when NATO tried to expand to include Georgia in 2008, or you know, the various overtures to Ukraine, etc. I don't think any honest person could really, you know, not understand where the impetus would be for, you know, joining NATO. At the same time, I think it's also probably important to note they're not asking our opinions, right? People of Eastern Europe are not asking what our opinion is of what they should do about their own futures. And I'm not going to sit here and say that I have all the answers and they're just stupid Eastern Europeans who don't understand anything. However, I will say that you should be very, very careful about what you wish for when it comes to NATO. More to the point, NATO would be perfectly happy to sacrifice the people of Eastern Europe when it comes down to it. So let's be very clear about how realist thinkers in the United States think about conflict with Russia. They think of Eastern Europe as the wasteland that will be obliterated so that the West can survive. But anyway, I don't want to go off on a tangent other than to say that I think that NATO is a very big problem and NATO should have long since been abolished. At the same time, we should keep in mind that it is Russia's war in Ukraine that is sustaining NATO.
Yes.
It's not the other way around.
Yep.
NATO was dragged through the mud in all of those conflicts that I previously mentioned. NATO's reputation was as low as it had ever been after 20 years in Afghanistan, the debacle in Libya, and all of the other crimes, right? NATO was seen as something that maybe needed to be reconsidered by some quarters of Europe, even. Okay. And then Russia invades Ukraine and instantly reestablishes NATO's entire reason for existence. Since that time, NATO's boots on the ground. I did a quick analysis of this. This is like 4 months ago, so it might be even worse now. But as of a few months ago, NATO's troop presence in Europe had increased 1,000%. Since the Russian invasion, NATO's military exercises are increasing exponentially. NATO membership has increased to welcome Finland and Sweden now into NATO, traditionally neutral countries. What's my point? My point is the war in Ukraine is fueling NATO. It is driving NATO. It is building NATO. It is reconstructing NATO. This is the other side of this that people are not they're either not getting it or they're deliberately ignoring this fact, or I don't know what. But the point is, the Russian war in Ukraine has built a NATO to last another 50, 75 years. And unfortunately for all of us who are anti-war activists and have been from the very beginning, our goal was always to end NATO. And instead, now we're in a bad situation where Russia is helping to fuel NATO and we find ourselves in the middle.
Yeah, I have nothing more to say. I think that's all accurate. A few times in this, you had stated, it depends who you're asking. It depends on the audience, right? So I think I want to end with this. And of course, you can add anything that you would like to, of course. But if there are folks watching this or listening to it, and they are authentically, genuinely interested in better understanding everything we talked about or other geopolitical events, things on the left, where do you suggest, including your work, but where do you suggest people look to when they say, well, I don't know. I mean, like it's YouTube is a thing that you use nowadays. Like, where should folks go?
I mean, look, I've answered this question in several different ways on different podcasts that I've been on. So, I don't know which is the best way to answer this. I will say this. For me, I can speak for myself. For me, when this war began, I immediately went back to Lenin. Because Lenin wrote about really all of the key issues that are driving everything that is going on in this war today. And I don't mean that like a nod to Lenin. He literally wrote about these specific issues, the notion of Ukrainian national identity, the notion of Ukraine's right to secede from great Russian chauvinism, the notion that Ukraine should not be subjugated to great, what he called great Russian chauvinism. This is all detailed in what became known as the right of nations to self-determination. Lenin wrote about these exact issues. And it's the history of the 20th century after Lenin's death that unfortunately never really led to a resolution of all of those issues, right? Because as we know, Lenin's death leads to the power struggle, which leads to Stalin's consolidation. Stalin, of course, was absolutely opposed to the idea of true self-determination for the peoples of the Soviet Union. And so that's how we get sort of that what became the next 30 years of history. But going back to Lenin, you find, so at least for me, I find a tremendous amount of insight into the very issues that are at the center of the war today. And I would point out that when the war began, for people who weren't paying attention at the time, Putin gave a particularly fiery speech that really inaugurated this war. It was essentially his declaration of war. And in that speech, it was without question the most virulently anti-communist speech I've ever heard. And that includes from the United States, from U.S. Presidents and so forth. It was vehemently anti-communist and particularly anti-Lenin, right? And Putin said that it was Lenin and the Bolsheviks who placed this time bomb under us, right? This tied into a lot of different ideas, right? This ties into the Protocols of the Elders of Zion and anti-Semitic global conspiracy theories, which hold that the Bolsheviks were part of a basically global Jewish conspiracy to overthrow, Christianity, Eastern Orthodox Christianity, and the Tsar, right? This is a longstanding far-right trope, and that was something that Putin wove directly into the speech that he gave opening this war. He also said that it was Lenin and the Bolsheviks who manufactured the idea of Ukraine, right? In other words, that Lenin created Ukraine and foisted this problem onto Russia, right? And why does Putin say that? Well, if you go back and read Lenin, you can see it very clearly. He hates everything that Lenin stood for when it came to the non-Russian peoples of the Russian Empire. Lenin stood for self-determination. Lenin, if he were writing about this war today, he would be using the exact same terminology, the same concepts, and the same ideas as 100 years ago. It's actually quite amazing if you go back and read it and then you apply it to today. I mean, I'm pulling out quote after quote where he's talking about Karl Marx's views on Ireland and how they related directly to what was going on in Ukraine. Ukraine is a super exploited colony of the Russian Empire, similar to Ireland as a exploited colony of the British, and on, right? So I say that because not just because of my whatever political and ideological viewpoint, but also because here is a theorist writing on the central issues that are still at play today. Right. So I would say, number one, I would say return to Lenin, read the Right of Nations to Self-Determination, read some of the other things that he wrote about Ukraine. You will find a tremendous amount of wisdom in there. I would also, again, I would, you know, return to a lot of the, you know, the tradition that we have on the left of understanding imperialism, of how we understand imperialism, not just Lenin, obviously high imperialism, the highest stage of capitalism, but many other writers who have since, you know, sort of taken up a lot of those ideas. I would also, I mean, one person who was important for me personally in understanding how I should view the world, Patrick Bond introduced me to the idea of sub-imperial rivalries and describing the non-US players, China, Russia, Turkey, India, as sub-imperial in nature and how they are in conflict with each other. I thought that was a really important insight. I mean, I'm just trying to give concrete examples. I mean, you could go back and read some of the really important history on Ukraine, on what was going on around the Russian Revolution, why Ukraine existed for a brief time as an independent state. The history of Ukrainian democracy is relevant going back 300 years. I would also say, actually, now that I'm thinking about it, I would also suggest that people really look at some history here, understand the history of this region and how these peoples came to be in the places that they are and how these borders were drawn. The fact that Ukraine, when Putin says Ukraine never really existed, in a sense, he's correct, because there was the Polish-Lithuanian Empire, followed by the Austro-Hungarian Empire and the Ottoman Empire and the Russian Empire, and these various empires in competition with each other, carving up Poland, carving up what we now call Ukraine, carving up different parts of the Balkans, etc. That's what led to World War I, for God's sake. So anyway, I just, the history is also important, because all of these questions that we're talking about today, Ukrainian sovereignty, Ukrainian self-determination, Ukraine as an anti-colonial struggle, all of that is connected to this history that I'm talking about.
I don't have anything more to say, man. That's excellent. I was taking some notes, and maybe I'll try to link some things into the description as well to point people into some of those directions.
Yeah, that would be great. I mean, Patrick is good. You should get Patrick on your show if you can. He's very good. But it's been a couple of years since I talked to him. I actually need to get him on my show again.
All right. So, Eric, man, thanks for coming on. You taught me a lot, and hopefully you can speak in the future.